the director of the Toda Peace Institute, and it gives me very great pleasure to welcome Dr. Gina Gustafsson from the Department of Government at the University of Uppsala and Nuffield College, Oxford, to talk with us about the recent electoral success of the Sweden Democrat Party and what this means for Swedish social democracy and its welfare state. The interview is part of a series on global challenges to democracy, which attempts to deepen our collective understanding of current trends and threats to democracy around the world, and perhaps more importantly, identify ways in which democratic values and institutions can become more resilient. Gina is an expert on political psychology and political culture, so she's well placed to talk with us about evolving Swedish attitudes towards democracy and their attitudes towards migrants and religious minorities, as well as the rising levels of xenophobia, not only in Sweden, but in other parts of Europe as well. So welcome, Gina. And I have great pleasure.
Thank you.
I have great pleasure also in welcoming my TODA colleague, Olivia Stokes Dreyer. Olivia and I will facilitate the dialogue and pose the question. So welcome to you as well, Olivia.
Thank you, Kevin.
Good. Gina, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your own intellectual background and values, and what sparked your interest in political psychology, political culture, and different types of nationalism?
Yes, absolutely. First of all, thank you for inviting me to this interesting conversation. So I've always combined political theory and political psychology, because it seems to me that many normative arguments that political theorists engage in are premised on empirical assumptions. And these empirical assumptions are not always fairly tested, because the people who are testing them might not always speak the language of the political theorists, so to speak. So, and I started off by looking at Isaiah Berlin, who distinguished between positive and negative liberty, and looking at whether or not people actually made such distinctions themselves today, and what the effects were of holding these different ideals of liberty. And then I moved on to debates that were topical at the time in my postdoc around 2005, 2006 on Muhammad cartoons and bans on Muslim veils. And I noticed that I kept coming back to the question of minority rights and, broadly speaking, liberalism, of course. And this eventually led me to the literature on liberal nationalism, and more specifically on what is called the national identity argument. The national identity argument is one of those typical empirical premises that is holds a great important place within a normative argument. And it is the idea that liberal, broadly speaking, liberal values, such as a deliberative, well-functioning democracy, citizen autonomy, but also some form of social justice and solidarity, that all these goods are dependent on some form of national cohesion and some form of national identity for people to be willing to, for example, share their resources with one another. And so I started looking at whether or not this was actually the case, and found that it's important to distinguish between different forms of national identification. So I found that national attachment, the feeling just of being Swedish and being close to one's compatriots, for example, is generally a benign force and connected to trust and solidarity. But there are also quite malignant and problematic dimensions, of course, such of national identity, such as national chauvinism, which is the idea of national superiority, and uncritical patriotism, the idea that my country, right or wrong, I need to defend it, and no one should slander it abroad.
Good, thank you for that.
Yeah, so Gina, as you know, we were particularly interested in getting your insights on the recent rise in power and strength of the Sweden Democrats. So for those of us who aren't so familiar with Swedish politics, can you tell us who are the Sweden Democrats? What are their origins? Where do they stand on the left-right spectrum? And how did they become the second largest party in the Swedish parliament with more than 20% of the vote?
Yes, the Sweden Democrats is a far-right populist party with a clear anti-immigrant agenda and also clearly Islamophobic leadership. It is not, however, your average right-wing populist party, because many of the other Nordic countries, such as Denmark and Norway, and also if you look further south in Europe, have populist parties that have grown out of resistance to the European Union and resistance to taxes. So slightly neoliberal populists, so to speak,
right,
where anti-immigration has also come in, but later on. The Sweden Democrats are, many would argue, more problematic even than those other parties, because they really grew out of the neo-Nazi and racist movements in the 70s, 1970s and the 1980s, especially a movement which was called Bevara Sverige Svenskt, which means keep Sweden Swedish, which was an openly racist organization founded in 1979. And out of that organization, about a decade later, the Sweden Democrats emerge. And many in the leadership of the Sweden Democrats were openly racist and even openly neo-Nazis as late as in the 1990s. And in 1994, when the current party leader, Jimmy Åkesson, joined the party, it was actually still run by a neo-Nazi. So this is a particularly problematic party in that regard. And now on the left-right scale, or the left-right continuum, I mean, that is extremely interesting, because they openly say in their manifesto that they want to combine the best elements, I'm quoting, of the traditional right and left-wing ideologies. And they also say that they see themselves as the main protectors and the heirs of the Swedish people's home, which is interesting, because that is, of course, a concept that most of us connect to the social democrats and the social democratic welfare state, which was supposed to include everyone in a warm people's home. And the idea was that in a home you don't play favorites, all your children are equally welcome, etc. But to be fair, the social democrats took this term of the people's home themselves in the 1930s from a conservative ideologist who was a professor at my current department in Uppsala, actually. And so there are conservative elements to the social democrats. So in a way, it's not entirely incoherent, in fact, for the Sweden Democrats to be saying that they want to protect the sort of conservative aspects of the welfare state. But also, if you look at them more economically speaking, they are the most left-wing economically among the right-wing parties that are currently ruling Sweden. And they firmly resisted some of the cutbacks that many of the on the more libertarian right in these parties wanted to engage in now. So they do place themselves on the left, slightly on the left, on the traditional economic left-right continuum, but clearly on the far right, on the more cultural left-right continuum.
No, I think that's really, really fascinating, because your the notion of kind of being on the left and on the right is very similar to what the Nazis were. I mean, they were the National Socialist Party. So in a way, that's continuing that lineage very well. I mean, in relation to that, I mean, how do you explain that sort of 12% of those who voted for the Democrats voted for the Social Democrats in the previous election and 14% for the Conservatives? And why was the party so popular with not only blue-collar workers, but Sweden's young first-time voters?
Yes, so I think the first part of your question, why did people who voted for the Social Democrats and the Conservative Party in the last elections, why did they end up voting for the Sweden Democrats? Is not as puzzling as the question of the younger voters. So if we start with the Social Democrats who now voted for the Sweden Democrats, this, I would say, goes back to the old concept from the 1950s that Lipset talks about, working class authoritarianism, essentially. Because if you look at the voters of many populist parties, but especially the Sweden Democrats, they are lower educated, less politically sophisticated, and somewhat alienated from the from the larger society, feeling much less trust, for example, than the average Swedes, and I think many feel betrayed by the Social Democrats not living up to their own ideals. So there is that aspect, but of course there is also the aspect of both the Social Democrats and particularly the Conservatives having, until recently, tried not to engage with the Sweden Democrats, and then only very recently, over the past 2 years, they've come to embrace part of the Sweden Democrats' discourse, I would say, connecting the two main issues on people's agenda, immigration and crime, with the existence of non-Nordic immigrants. And I mean, to give you a bit of background, it is the case that the share of the foreign-born population in Sweden has grown drastically over the last two decades. And for example, around the turn of this last century, around year 2000, that share was about 10% of the population, and now it's more than 20%. And we know, if you look at voters' attitudes, we know that already sometime in between around 2010, the Swedish voters in general were starting to become much more hesitant about immigration than the overall party system, including the right. And only the Sweden Democrats, unfortunately, were at that time sort of phrasing those ideas. And so now that the others have shifted, it's a bit too late in a way for them to own that question. So they sort of legitimize this idea. But of course, the Sweden Democrats have said that we have too many immigrants and that they're taking over Swedish culture all along. They said that already in the 80s and certainly in the early 1990s. So for them, this is an existential question, not really connected to the more economic concerns and crime that has that is in fact a factor, because that's another aspect. The top concern on the voters' agenda this year was lethal shootings and crime, because Sweden has sailed up to number one in Europe when it comes to fatal shootings. We've had about 300 already this year, 74 that have had people wounded and 48 that have been fatal. And this, you have to think of, is in a country of 10 million people, so it's a rather small population. About the same, I think, as New Zealand. So this is high up on people's agenda, and the Sweden Democrats have said all along that this is just immigrants being not non-Swedish, basically. And unfortunately, I think what happened during this run-up to the elections was that most of the other parties also discussed crime as a matter of migration. So there were all sorts of suggestions. For example, the Social Democratic Minister of Integration, he touted the idea of helping neighborhoods with crime rates by introducing ethnic quotas to keep the number of non-Nordic inhabitants under a certain threshold. This has been tried in Denmark. the Liberal Party, who now collaborate with the Sweden Democrats, but who used to be very strongly against them. They suggested that two-year-olds with foreign-born parents needed to have their Swedish skills tested, and that if parents refused to send them to Swedish nurseries, social services might be called in. So you see the sort of proposals, and these were all connected to crime. two-year-olds. I mean, that's pretty harsh.
Yeah.
And to compete with the Sweden Democrats, that other parties started to sing the same tune, or do you think this was just coming from other places or in response to this growing crime rate?
I think there was a very great concern that the Sweden Democrats were taking away voters from the two largest parties, the Conservatives and the Social Democrats above all, who are still the largest party. The Sweden Democrats are now number two. But that was clearly a concern. And also, I wanted to come back to the question of young people, because that is, I think, even more disconcerting and puzzling. I don't know if the name Greta Thunberg is famous over there. Yes,
she is.
It is, yes.
Very.
She is, right? So it's her generation, the first time voters, who to a great extent voted for the Sweden Democrats. And the Sweden Democrats, mind you, they're not only xenophobic, they also have a non-existent climate policy platform. One of the top names is questioning, global warming. So from a climate point of view, this is also very much against Greta Thunberg's message. And I think this was a bit unexpected for quite a few analysts, even, that so many young people voted for them. And when it comes to explaining that, I think we still don't have very good scientific explanations yet. But just anecdotally, I think one aspect, we know that young people can sometimes vote slightly more out of the box or for more untraditional parties in their first elections. So it might be that they won't be going back to them. Maybe this won't. Maybe this is not. Won't be a recurring phenomenon. And secondly, they were very strong, the Sweden Democrats, on social media. They had. They're good with memes. They're good with short TikTok videos that are shocking people. Often, they're on the verge of the anti-Semitic or what might be shocking. For example, one of their main names and in a social media influencer, basically, she wrote on Twitter a couple of weeks ago reading Anne Frank's diary. She was making fun of her, basically, and that sort of thing gets attention, sadly. Yeah. And sadly, also, the Sweden Democrats have been connected to actually troll factories. So they seem to be engaging in steering social media content to some extent and spreading disinformation and misinformation. So that's another really disconcerting angle.
Many of us have this image, perhaps over-idealized, of Swedish population as being inclusive, egalitarian, cosmopolitan, tolerant, sort of this exemplary social democracy. And is there something wrong about that perception? You write that in the past, Swedes have not had an ethnic conception of nationalism. So in this regard, are the Sweden Democrats something of an exception to what those of us on the outside have regarded as Swedish progressive values, or do they represent some more deeply held xenophobic beliefs that have perhaps been there all along and in many ways are resistant to the values of an inclusive social democracy?
I think that's an excellent question, because I agree with that there's this image of Sweden, a dreamy image around the world that is being questioned now. And first of all, I would say that it's important to distinguish between the party itself and its platform and its leadership and the manifesto, which is clearly ethnically nationalist and conservative. They're openly social conservatives Although Sweden being a quite gender equal society, they're not very conservative when it comes to sexuality and gender equality. But there have been instances when they, for example, want to remove the rainbow flag, the pride flag in certain municipalities, etc. So there is that element in the actual party platform. But to understand why so many, after all, a fifth of the voters voted for them, I think we need to think a bit more broadly. And and I think that it would be wrong or mistaken to assume that we're seeing some sort of conservative backlash specifically. So I think what we're seeing is less of a, among the voters that is, less of the backward looking conservatism and more of an inward looking authoritarian tendency to promote unity over diversity. And when I'm saying that, I'm relying on a distinction that I think is helpful by political psychologist Karen Stenner, who has shown in numerous studies that it's important to distinguish between the drive to avoid change or future uncertainty, which is the heart of conservatism on the one hand, and the wish to avoid difference and complexity and to some extent discord on the other, which is the heart of authoritarianism. And she's shown that it's the latter, not the former, that actually leads to intolerance, like wanting to restrict minorities' rights. And I think it's the latter we're seeing in Sweden. I think Sweden is a good example of how the two come apart, because many Swedes are very progressive, embrace modernity, take great pride in technical innovations. They're not very fussy about the national heritage, history, culture, that sort of nationalism. But at the same time, there is a strong aversion to difference. And this has been documented again and again. A good example is from the 1980s, where ethnologist Åke Daun showed that the average Swede found it very uncomfortable to be around people whose values and ideas they did not themselves share. So in the neighboring Scandinavian countries, the number of percentage of people who dislike this sort of company was only about 4 to 6%. But in Sweden, the figure was 45%. So almost half of the population were very uncomfortable hanging out with people with different ideas and values.
And it sounds like what you're saying, that in some ways that it's not feeling like a big change then.
No, exactly. I can't say that with a 100% certainty, because I don't have continuous data on those attitudes. But I do think that there's an element of Swedishness that the Swedish Democrats are actually capturing rather well. And that is a fear of difference that exists, of course, everywhere. I mean, this Karen Stenner's work is not in particular on Sweden. She shows that this is a sizable part of the electorate everywhere. And what is most important with her work, I think, is that she shows that it has to be triggered by a certain situation. So the authoritarians who are hesitant about difference, they could very well be good Democrats until a certain situation arises and triggers their authoritarianism. And that sort of situation is when you perceive that there's a threat against the in-group, a threat against the myth of unity or the idea that we used to be so united. And I think that is certainly a general narrative that we see, I think, in many places. And in many places, it's true that polarization is growing, etc. But in Sweden, polarization is not as big as it's made out to be. So there's a lot of talk about, oh, we are so divided nowadays. But actually, to some extent, that has to do with the ghost of polarization, because there's not a lot of polarization when scientists look at that particular phenomenon. So I think that narrative is part of triggers authoritarianism. And of course, immigration, the way we have talked about immigration over the past few years, where it has been connected to crime and the general cultural threat. Because for the Sweden Democrats, immigrants threaten Swedishness by definition.
Mm-hmm. So in relation to that sort of, you know, what we might call the politics of fear and the manipulation of fear, you know, do the Swedish people in response to that look to towards, both on the left and the right, look towards authoritative, if not authoritarian, leadership? That is, they want people leading them who can best embody that sort of Swedish unity and nationalism. And in your book on Why Liberalism Today, you suggest that some form of nationalism is a national corollary to national identity. So what form of nationalism would support liberal values in Sweden today? And what sort of leadership would be able to articulate that?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? the problem is not really a very conservative or ethnic form of nationalism, although that is what the Sweden Democrats stand for. But if you look at the electorate, generally speaking, very few people in Sweden, fewer in Sweden than elsewhere in Europe, think that the Swedish culture or language or history is superior to others. So that is not the main problem, to me at least. If we instead look at different dimensions of national identity, Sweden stands out on some other dimensions. So one of them is whether or not it's a good thing that your co-patriots criticize your own country. And there we have a problem, because Swedes stand out by having the smallest share of people who think this is a good idea. Among all the surveyed countries that I've looked at, about 30 countries in Europe and also in North America, with about only 5% of Swedes saying it's a very good thing for other Swedes who, to criticize our country. So I think self-critique is something that is lacking. And I think that feeds into the Sweden Democrats to some extent, because the Sweden Democrats, they are voicing a very strong, not self-critique, but a critique of the establishment, like all populists. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And to some extent, they have a point, because the establishment in Sweden is very reluctant to see or concede any problems with Sweden. It's part of the national brand that we have, I think, very, very successfully yes. spread around the world, right? That we are inclusive and everything. But also that we are a safe society with little crime, that we are a well-functioning welfare state, and a stable democracy, etc. And all these things are now up in the air all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. So I think this is disconcerting for many who are in no way racists themselves. And I think the pandemic, for me at least, the pandemic brought that out. Mm-hmm. Because as you may remember, Sweden shocked the world already then by going at it alone, by choosing a more individualistic approach with no lockdowns, very little testing, virtually no masks for a long time. I've done some research trying to understand why so many Swedes nevertheless supported that strategy. Interestingly enough, what we find is that it's not really to do with trust, or individualism, valuing freedom versus valuing the collective. But the main determinant of defending the Swedish pandemic strategy, we find, is actually a form of national identity. So we see that Swedes were very proud to be Swedish, and Swedes were in particular proud of Swedish institutions. They are more likely to rally around this strategy And also Swedes were uncritical, the element of uncritical patriotism that I that I noted previously. And also finally, those who are national chauvinists who believe that their country, in this case Sweden, is better than other countries. Sadly, and what brings immigrants back into this is that this strategy, which still remains, if you ask people, many are very happy, both left and right, with what Sweden did, despite a lot of evidence having come out now, how it affected, above all, actually, immigrants. So this is a troubling aspect, because we started seeing really early on in the pandemic that, for example, if you were born in Africa, if you're a Swede or an immigrant in Sweden, born in Africa, you were three times more likely to die of COVID than if you were a Swede born in Sweden. Wow. And this is because we have a large-scale segregation with immigrants living in much worse conditions, much less able to work from home, which was the general advice. They tend to work in the front line. And drive taxis, for example. So the taxi driver community, who to some extent are Somali-born, were very strongly hit by the pandemic. And what surprised me was how few seem to care about this and to consider these casualties Swedish casualties in a way. So I think segregation also plays a huge role here. I mean, the way people live, actually, the people don't meet immigrants, the country, they know that there's a lot of immigrants, there's this narrative, and they know that this it's connected to crime, but they don't really have a lot of contact with foreign borns, because there is a wide-scale segregation, and this segregation is often blamed on the immigrants, but that is also, as always, deeply problematic, because we know that there's a lot of white flight going on, and that Swedes tend to have a low threshold to diversity in their neighborhood before they start looking for another home and moving away. So
yeah,
so that's an aspect.
Gina, one of the things we think about as we look at global challenges to democracy and rise in authoritarianism is this politics of fear and mobilizing around fear, and very often fear of immigration and crime. And we certainly have seen that in the U.S. You've described how the Sweden Democrats did mobilize around that in the election, and how the other political parties in many ways joined the bandwagon. Do you see a sort of increasing politics of fear in Sweden? Is that one of the trends you're noticing?
I certainly think that there is a rise in the politics of fear. There is a fear of crime, the most concrete fear that has risen over the past few years and is understandable, although not proportionate to the likelihood, of course, to get caught in one of these horrible shootings. But you understand, of course, that in a society which is a very high trust society, where we haven't had a lot of gun violence, these changes are quite noticeable, and people talk about them. So that's the most obvious fear. But of course, there is also a more cultural fear, and that is the fear that the Sweden Democrats are often playing into, a fear of immigrants having, being a threat to Swedish so-called values. I think the narrative of immigrants being less trusting is especially interesting. I'm interested in looking into this further, because it also came out during the pandemic, the idea that immigrants, what will get us all through this is to trust each other, and mainly to trust the authorities. And then it was brought out as a big problem that immigrants are less trusting, as they tend to be in most societies, because they are more marginalized. And when the vaccinations were rolled out, this also had the implication that immigrants were more hesitant to get vaccinated for understandable trust-related reasons. And this was also framed as a huge betrayal or a very problematic aspect of immigrants.
Moving on from that, Gina, you've already mentioned that the Sweden Democrats were populist. Was their leadership sort of charismatic, I mean, autocratic, if not authoritarian, and chauvinistic? And obviously that played very well with the electorate. And how does that square with my sort of assumption that Swedish political culture sort of normally militates against personality politics and celebrity leadership?
Your assumption is quite correct. And the Sweden Democrats, I think, are well aware of the Swedish culture being like that. So what they do is that their own leadership is not very charismatic or authoritarian. There's no real Trump figure or Steve Bannon type of figure. There are these people like the social media influencer whom I mentioned, who was joking about Anne Frank's diary on Twitter, and they have these lower strata of the party who are sending out dog whistles occasionally, but the high up leadership, and especially the party leader Jimmy Åkesson, he very much tries to, I think, conform to the idea of your average guy, a normal, well-behaved, very, you know, non-elitist, but also quite able to speak and speak well, that sort of guy. And the card that he has tended to play is instead, oh, me and my party, we are being bullied by the establishment. Why would they be so naughty to us? nasty to us? Why are they not letting us take part in politics? Because they have been basically ostracized until these elections. And now there's a huge switch, or this is a big shift that they are so clearly in a position of they don't have ministerial seats, but they are the largest party in the governing coalition. So I think it's not as charismatic as you might think when you think of Trump, etc. But to be fair, this party does have links to these other international populists, and above all to Hungary and to Viktor Orban.
Yes.
Even like one of their main politicians, Kent Ekeroth, he has even gone to live there for a while, himself being an immigrant then in another country, and is now back in politics in Sweden. And they have even said openly a few years ago, some of the main leadership said things like, well, Sweden is not Hungary yet, so we have to adjust our rhetoric.
No.
So they are openly in awe of what Orban has done in Hungary. And what Orban started doing was he went against mainly against the media and started limiting freedom of speech and generally pluralism in the debate. And that's, I think, a major fear that this is what they will eventually try to do.
And are those concerns post-election now being openly expressed that they will continue to rise in strength and be sort of part of the mainstream politics of Sweden? Or what has that been like since the election?
Yes, people are voicing concerns, but it has become rather politicized so that people who support the right-wing coalition, even those who are not Sweden Democrats, have tended to downplay all these concerns and even ridicule them, which I think became problematic, especially when leaders of Jewish organizations made a big thing out of the fact that this is a party with roots in neo-Nazi movements, and the fact that the Conservative Party only recently said we promise you, the people who have been through the Holocaust, that we will not collaborate with them. And now they broke that promise. And there has been sort of this, I think, sort of harsh, almost ridiculing tone from people, at least in social media on the right, whenever these concerns are voiced now, especially from Jews or immigrants, you know, which is like, oh, what do you think? So we won't have elections again in 4 years? Come on, be realistic. And of course, no one is saying Sweden won't have elections in 4 years or 8 years or 12 years. That is not the threat. But the threat is, for example, something like the anti-discrimination law. The anti-discrimination law has already been questioned by one of the major Sweden Democrats, who is now in charge, partly of legal issues, and they have a sort of rhetoric which is very much about politics being an existential struggle between the strong and the weak, which is what the Nazis had also. So I think the ethos of democracy, and mainly perhaps the liberal aspects of democracy, like pluralism and anti-discrimination laws, etc., those are the first things that are possibly under threat.
My goodness. So you write some about the concept of national belonging. Could you say a little bit more about how you understand that? And was that concept in some way problematized by the Sweden Democrats?
Yes, so I think they are openly talking about national belonging as something different than citizenship. And they've done so for a while. For example, there was a TV debate in the last elections in 2018 when unemployment was discussed, and when the party leader Jimmy Åkesson said something like, well, we all know the unemployment rates are to a large extent driven by the fact that many of these people are just not Swedish. That's why they won't get jobs. And what he's talking about is immigrants who in many cases might have Swedish citizenship, which has been fairly easy in relation to, if you compare around Europe, to achieve in Sweden until now, but will be more difficult now. But he nevertheless would not call them Swedish because they, according to him, don't have a Swedish nationality or don't belong to the national us. But they're not very clear on this. So they have both the dog whistles, as always, where they say things like the Sami, the Jewish community, they are their own nations. They're not part of the Swedish nation, but they should have minority rights. They haven't actually said they shouldn't have that yet. But still, they say they're not nationally speaking Swedish. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they do say that, you know, immigrants who want to adapt to Swedish values and who want to become Swedish and who fully embrace Swedish traditions, they can become Swedish. So that they're not 100% ethnically exclusivists, so to speak. But generally speaking, if you look at the Swedish population, until now at least, Swedes have been rather civic in their conception of who belongs, who is a proper Swede, which means that when you ask them what sort of markers define a real Swede, they tend to mention having Swedish citizenship and also, to a great extent, speaking Swedish, the language, and not so much having Swedish ancestors. So that's the general notion of nationhood, I would say, is largely civic in Sweden. But that does not, of course, necessarily make it very open or tolerant or self-critical.
Right, as you've described, But something needs to be shifting with the Sweden Democrats, that the sense of what national belonging is narrowing.
Yeah. In relation to that, I mean, how robust and resilient are Swedish political institutions? I mean, from the outside, we just assume that they're very strong, very much kind of governed by the rule of law and so forth. And do the Swedish Democrats basically accept the institutions they are and work to pursue the policies within that, or do they want to subvert them?
This is a matter of how much we trust what they say. So remember I said they openly said something like, Sweden is not Hungary yet, and so we need to adjust our rhetoric. So if you take that line, then you can't really trust what they're saying, because their rhetoric is adjusted. And they have been talking about journalists as their main enemy, and the media as their main enemy, the mainstream media, that is, for a long time. And even now, after the elections, leadership has joked about playing journalist rugby, meaning, you know, boxing or hitting journalists. So there is certainly a contempt for the media among them. And that is an element I think that we will see more of, because so far the new government has not let them slash public service or anything. Like the Swedish state television, Swedish state radio has been left intact so far. But I think the Sweden Democrats, if they have the possibility, they would very happily get rid of lots of people in those institutions. And that was one of the first things that Orban did in Hungary, for example.
Yes, yes.
So that's one aspect. Which has to do with the pluralism in the public debate.
Yeah, attacking freedom of speech everywhere is a sort of a sure sign that you're well on the way towards a very authoritarian polity.
Exactly. Unless, of course, you are celebrating the freedom of speech of those who are openly Islamophobic, because there's also that, of course. And then I think the other aspect that is deeply worrying, and that is coming through in the new policies of the government, more so than the contempt for media in general, is the lack of equality before the law when it comes to asylum seekers and immigrants. So what the new government is suggesting is a sort of politicization of the asylum seeking process. So you have to bear in mind that many of the Swedish immigrants are in fact asylum seekers and refugees coming from Somalia, Iraq, Syria over the past 10 years. And what they're saying in the new agreement, the new government, is that they want to make sure that we only do the bare minimum that the European Union requires in the process of granting asylum. So, for example, they want to look over the right to have a translator present, or the right to have legal help in this process. So that's one of the things. And then thirdly, there is the aspect of citizens with double citizenship. Because now all of a sudden there's this new formulation in a document that the new government has produced, where they say that the moral stature of people with a foreign background could become grounds for extraditing them from Sweden. So not only crime, because that's already been on the agenda before, not only engaging in criminal activities, but also, for example, engaging in drug abuse or prostitution, which is, according to Swedish law, being a prostitute is actually being the victim of a crime. It's not criminal. It's to be a prostitute. It is criminal to buy sexual favors. So that is an aspect that hasn't been, I mean, the courts don't know what to do with this yet. But that is a concern that people with double citizenship could be extradited based on their sort of moral character, or they use a very old-fashioned term that we haven't heard from since the 1930s, essentially, for this.
Oh, that sounds very.
So, of course, it will be the rights. It will be the rights of non-native Swedes and their descendants. That's the main target of the of their policies, of course.
Yeah. Oh, it's very disconcerting.
Yeah. So we do see ultra right-wing political parties across Europe increasing in popularity. You've already mentioned some links between Sweden Democrats and Hungary. To what extent do you see the Sweden Democrats either following or leading, or perhaps some of each, such trends? And what are you seeing around the links, either informal or formal? Do they go beyond Hungary? I mean, we now have a ultra-right-wing party in Italy. And from your vantage point in general, what do you see as the future of the ultra-right in Europe? I'm sure it's hard to say, but just any insights you have.
Yes, so first of all, the Sweden Democrats, they do collaborate within the European Union, which they are basically against. But within the European Union, they collaborate with UKIP when the UK was still part of the European Union, and the Italian Five Star Movement. So this was before the now rising post-fascist party became really big. And now they recently changed their party group. So they now collaborate with the British Tories, which used to be the British Tories, and the governing nationalists from Poland, another example that is going along the same route as Hungary. And also the Danish People's Party are in that EU collaboration. And outside of that, they've also got links with the French Front National. And they have clearly been inspired by Trump and Steve Bannon. Yeah. Last time I saw any of them in person was when I happened to be in Budapest in Hungary for a conference, and the conference was on migration, and we were all very taken aback when at the conference restaurant, all of a sudden there were all these right-wing anti-immigrant politicians, because apparently Orban had invited them, including Steve Bannon, to a big rally in Hungary. And then I saw several top Sweden Democrats there as well. Mm-hmm. And I think what they have in common and what they're learning from each other, I'm sure, although I'm not an expert on this particular area, is how to use social media in an advantageous way. And I think the fact that the Sweden Democrats did turn out to be running one of these troll factories with people working to manipulate social media right before the elections. It was jarring that that happened, but even more jarring that it got so little attention. Mm-hmm. I don't really know what that is about. If maybe the younger generation, younger than me, are already so cynical that they don't expect anything less of them, or they just don't care, or that's difficult to tell. But I think the social media aspect is really, really disconcerting. And I think overall, when it comes to how the far right will fare in Europe, I think it has a lot to do with discourse and not just demography. So when many say that the Sweden Democrats rose to power because of Sweden's immigration policies, I think that's far too simplified, because what really triggered at least the success in these last elections was how immigrants were talked about in the public debate on the left and right. And I think so other parties and actors throughout Europe and in the world generally have a difficult balance to strike, I think, because they have to, on the one hand, cater to these concerns. They cannot, as many Swedish politicians did up until a few years ago, brand anyone who is concerned about immigration a racist. That just won't fly anymore. But on the other hand, they shouldn't go too far in the other direction and start talking about all the problems, for example, of crime. Or we haven't even talked about the erosion of the welfare state, but that's another aspect, of course, as problems that immigrants are driving. And I think that how people talked about the Ukrainian refugees this spring, early this spring, when the war started in Ukraine, was a good reminder of the fact that how we talk about immigrants matters. Many wanted to put the difference in how Ukrainian refugees were met and, say, Syrian refugees down to racism. And, of course, racism played a part. Many Ukrainians look like me. You can't distinguish them from many, many Swedes. But I think that also what mattered was that all of a sudden, no one was bringing out the main differences. And there are many differences between, in our case, the average Swede and the average Ukrainian. When it comes to religiosity, when it comes to views on gender, on homosexuality, on violence or war and versus pacifism. But no one's really talking about that this spring for understandable reasons. Everyone was united against a common enemy in Sweden, sharing the coast with the Baltic states. There's a very tangible feeling of Putin's Russia being a threat. And so many opened their homes to Ukrainian refugees and did not question their right to come. And that actually included also the Sweden Democrats to a great extent, which was interesting to see. But again, I don't think I wouldn't put all that down to racism and just people not fearing these blonde Ukrainians. I think it also had to do with the discourse constantly reminding us of our shared enemies and our shared concerns and not reminding us of our differences.
In that regard, was there any indication or any evidence that Russian trolls were behind or were engaged in the last Swedish election?
I must say that's not my expertise, but I've heard people saying that. And I know that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs certainly are constantly working with that. So that has certainly happened during, let's say, the last couple of years. And another aspect which is interesting about the Sweden Democrats is that they have quite a lot of links to Russia and Putin. Some of them have been there as sort of democracy experts.
Yes.
And they have until recently, until this spring, they were also against the joining the NATO, as was the Swedish left. And now Sweden is joining the NATO and the Sweden Democrats have flipped. But this is not necessarily a party that you want to have involved in foreign relations during a very sensitive time. And the government has understood that, so they haven't given them a lot of power in any way about over our foreign policies, but they have given them more power over our internal policies when it comes to immigration.
And so it remains for me, Gina, to kind of just thank you on behalf of the Tode Peace Institute, both for a kind of a lively analysis of the Sweden Democrats and what that means for Swedish politics, but also for giving us some inkling as to the similarities between the right-wing movements in Sweden and in Australia and New Zealand and the US and elsewhere. The patterns seem to me to be fairly similar in terms of hostility towards migrants, intolerance of civil liberties, and a generalized disrespect for the law. But most of all, I think what you kind of underlined for me is this sense in which we should begin framing a lot of this opposition to democracy in terms of authoritarianism versus democracy, and that the authoritarian personality type, which Lipset and others talked about, and authoritarian leaders, Trump being probably a classic example, but Orban and others being exemplary as well. I mean, I think that poses the real threat to our ongoing lively democracies. So I just want to give you deepest thanks again for your acute observations and your wonderful analysis of all of these dynamics.